And now we're with Andre Vilcek, and he's something of a wandering intellectual. His home is the world, and he's someone who can see relations of exploitation and domination as if they are solid bonds. You know, he spends a great deal of time investigating the so-called developing world, the global South, from its own standpoint, not North American or Western European standpoint, but from its own standpoint, from the perspective of the people living there, their needs, their dreams, struggles, and aspirations, something you don't see Western academics or journalists do very much. In fact, Andre, I'd say you're perhaps somewhat critical of Western academics, academia in general, aren't you?
Oh, well, I am. I'm actually very critical of Western academia, although they do keep inviting me. I speak at some big universities once in a while, but I think they use me as a, they need to have somebody a little bit diverse. So once in a while I appear at Oxford, Cambridge, Sydney University in Australia. I definitely don't belong to the mainstream, and I don't like to describe myself as being part of academia, although some of my articles are academic.
Indeed, it's kind of in the way you have someone like Michael Parenti or Noam Chomsky or John Pilger being brought to speak. They are the exception rather than the rule. A sense I get from your articles is that the West is becoming a place of cultural uniformity or homogeneity. And I think one of the main areas that you've investigated is the art scene, the art galleries, museums, paintings. What are some of your criticisms of Western art as it stands now?
Well, in a recent article, which was published by Counterpunch, I addressed the issue of the Western arts as to compare to Chinese arts. Because if you read Western critics or academics, they constantly write about China as being a country which censors arts, where there is no freedom of expression. I argued actually that there is not much freedom of expression in the West, so there is not much credibility when these arguments are made in the West. Let's look at the Western arts for the last, let's say, 4 or 5 centuries. You go to Louvre, you go to Museo del Prado in Madrid, and what do you see? You actually see a lot of art which was fully dependent on the sponsors from the, be there kings or aristocracy or whatever. You see a lot of religious art as well. Most of it is actually religious or somehow related to the seats of power. And we are talking about the countries like France or Spain, which were colonizing one half of the world and plundering several continents, and there is no criticism of this plunder. I mean, there is basically nothing, almost nothing, that you would see in Prado that would show tremendous suffering of people what is now Latin America, Central and South America. There is nothing of it. In Louvre, very little, almost nothing. So until now, there is. If you go to the galleries in New York or in Sydney or in Paris, you see almost nothing that would be showing the horrible colonial or neocolonialism that is plundering the world. So you have to go to other countries. Recently, I was in Santiago de Chile in the Museum of Human Memory and Human Rights, basically enormous, beautiful museum dedicated to the Chilean dictatorship and Western foreign policy towards Latin America. And what did I see? I saw great Colombian sculptor and painter Botero exhibiting paintings of torture in Abu Ghraib. I mean, that's art, but he's Colombian. He's not Western. So then, what I'm arguing in my piece is then you go to galleries in Beijing or you go to galleries in Shanghai, and they are much more vibrant. You see everything from criticism of Western imperialism to the social issues in China. Basically, artists in China are demanding social justice. They are demanding more socialism, not lesser. And you see the issues of everything from like rural poverty or, you know, man not being able to marry because there is more men than women in some rural parts of China and so on, which are topics that are very important and very provocative, and you just don't see these types of you don't go to big galleries in Paris or London and see like exhibitions on homelessness or lonely debt or issues that are so relevant for Europe.
Absolutely. I think what you've done is you've connected art in the West and in a global South to a narrative of empire and power. So as you mentioned, there's all these artists, these famous European artists over the centuries who have painted beautiful nudes and nature scenes and churches and things like that. But as you pointed out, there's no painting of French soldiers killing the last people on a Caribbean island, for example.
Exactly, like in Grenada, right? I mean, Grenada, we all know about the U.S. invasion to Grenada, which was horrific. They even bombed like a mental hospital just because it was the only building in St. George's which had a red roof. But we don't know anything about the French genocide when they basically killed almost all, if not all, inhabitants of the same island centuries earlier.
Right. In the West, we're supposed to have this unique freedom, this unique ability to express ourselves, but it seems you always have to express what your patron wants. And now, I mean, that has consequences as far as the modern art galleries are. I think you've kind of painted a picture, as it were, about Western art galleries as being the sort of same gallery over and over again, no matter where you are. It's the same hors d'oeuvres being served. Everything's been tamed and homogenized. So you see a definite difference between the palette, the availability inside and outside Western countries.
Yes, and I also think that what you just described, it has a history. It's in a modern art, especially after the Second World War, there is a problem that the ideological war or Cold War and propaganda in the West were very closely linked to the art which was promoted, which is basically form over the substance. And we saw it in Paris Review and confessions of the chief editor of Paris Review that it was basically the whole Paris Review, which was full of nudes and daring, sexual acts on the pages of that magazine. It was actually run by the CIA, and he confessed that it was because. And why would they do it? Because the form over substance is exactly what the establishment in the West wants art to become, just a decorative thing.
Well, there's a common theme in that article and in other articles, a sort of injection of nihilism, deliberate or otherwise. So there's extensions of Western art galleries in other countries, and they promote certain values.
Yes, the nihilism is very important. It keeps people from thinking. It keeps people from daring, from rebelling. If you have nihilism, you don't have revolution, and everything is trivialized. Everything is actually made fun of. The Western art is very good at trivializing things or making fun of ideals. You know, we're not supposed to believe in anything. We're not supposed to believe in revolution. We are not supposed to believe in socialism. We are not supposed to believe in Marxism. It's all pathetic. It's all laughable. And what do we have left? I mean, we have fears of not getting erections, fears of getting old, fears of dying. This is what you read in the contemporary novels. I mean, what you see in art galleries, and that's actually in better galleries, because otherwise you're just dealing with the geometrical forms and things that everybody complains nobody can understand except the critics. But so, you know, if you get at least to erections and lonely death and all this, at least that's some substance. But
yes.
Often you don't get even that.
It seems, I mean, half of that art is things that businessmen would be concerned about. Again, failing erections or dying alone. Or my favorite, self-discovery, finding yourself. You know, there's a lot of artists and writers in the United States who have nothing to paint or write about. But in the rest of the world, as you said, there's an emergence of radical art once again. And I tend to make fun of people from the West who seek what they call authentic experiences as tourists in the global South. But that aside, if you're looking for art, it seems you really do need to seek authenticity in the global South. You mentioned Santiago de Chile, and I was in Cuba and I saw quite a number of art exhibits. Flourishing, dynamic, very new, and China was a focus of your article. So you had mentioned that there were the paintings of people unable to find wives. There's other issues in China. What kind of issues are these Chinese paintings addressing?
Well, there is a lot of political issues. There is a lot of issues dealing even with the development of their cities. I mean, there is a great progress in public transportation and all this, but hutongs, the historic neighborhoods are being demolished. Some people think it's good because you need decent housing for the majority. Some people think it's bad, so there is a big fight. Art is involved in this. Art is involved in social justice. I mean, China is becoming middle-class country, but it still has pockets of poverty. They deal with it. I mean, the artists are outraged that their country cannot feed everybody on the higher level that it does, and you know, they are actually pushing for progress, and Chinese public is responding. I mean, there is a you know, in Beijing and Shanghai you have these enormous art cities. In Beijing we have something called 798, which was a weapon factory. It was tremendous, and the government just gave it to the artists. They don't pay rent, some do. But it's just hundreds of art galleries full of avant-garde theaters, funkiest cafes, everything. And this is where the ideas are being recycled all the time and injected. It's a big fight over ideas, ideology, everything. You see the same in Shanghai. You have it's bit smaller than in Beijing, but you're really talking about something that puts to shame Chelsea or Soho in London. It's enormous.
Yes, you know,
it's simply enormous, and it's very daring.
It is. I continue to be impressed by your ability to articulate your article and recall the process that was involved in writing that and similar articles for Counterpunch and your website and other publications. I noticed on the article about art in China that there's a number of pictures or photos enclosed of some of the exhibits. I think you're one of the few or only people on Counterpunch that actually gets pictures attached to their articles. And I noticed that my favorite, there was the one you had, you mentioned the one about Western torture that's occurring right now, and that was a stunning photograph of a painting. And there was the aircraft carrier. I enjoyed that one. It showed a bunch of mountaintops, a mountain area being devastated, and in the center there's this ominous aircraft carrier, as you describe. And that could be a common...
Yes. That's the Chinese, that's the one in Shanghai, the gallery in Shanghai, and the torture painting that you mentioned, that's the greatest Colombian painter, Botero, who actually is known for nudes, for a corpulent women with red buttocks and everything. And you have this painter who just gets outraged about Muslim men being tortured in Abu Ghraib, and he just abandons his, you know, his nudes. And he just begins torture, you know, depicting the torture of Muslim men, basically raped by dogs, and it's amazing. It's incredible transformation. But it comes from Colombia. It doesn't come from the West.
Yes, and as far as China goes, you've referred to a few critics, or at least one critic who said perhaps China is now the avant-garde. It is now the place where the most notable art is originated.
Yes, because actually I went to Sydney, Australia, and Sydney is very close to China culturally, because there is a lot of Chinese students, and Australians are discovering I mean, they're part of that entire region. So some of the best galleries, actually, of Chinese art are in Sydney, not in New York, not in London. And I visited several big institutions, including White Rabbit, and I talked to art collectors and critics about this. And it was actually was for the previous article I did for China Daily. But I recycled interviews in Counterpunch, and they said, yes, I mean, basically there is no political art in Australia anymore. I mean, there is some, of course, indigenous people rebelling about the situation in which they are. But in general, there is very little. So, I mean, when they need some a breath of Chinese art, I mean, the political art, they import Chinese paintings. And it's absurd, because this is the one of the richest countries on earth, in many ways very creative, but they cannot produce the art, or they are not capable of encouraging their artists to react to the political situation in Australia. So, I mean, the political art in Australia is Chinese.
Wow, and you know, and we can't reproduce or produce this kind of commentary about what's happening in the art world here in Canada. We have to rely and be thankful for the internet websites like your own and Counterpunch, because that's the only way we can learn about this and the only way we can get perspectives on a number of other issues as well. For example, right now in the news, we've been hearing a lot about Venezuela because of the commemoration of President Chavez.
Yes.
Now, we're not exactly giving commemoration here in the West in the same way. There was an article in the Miami Herald that was reproduced in my hometown, and it was basically excoriating President Chavez and saying he had accomplished nothing and it was anti-democratic, the usual kind of narratives that are recycled with anyone who tries to break from the Western orbit. Now, you wrote a recent article. It was actually more of a poem, and let me just quote briefly from that, actually. When we lose people that are indispensable to us, nothing may change on the surface. We are still walking, eating, sleeping, working, even fighting. The void, the gaping hole, is what dominates our hearts and our souls. Now, that was in reference to President Chavez, and I think you've felt this on a personal level, much in the way that people in Venezuela and people that were inspired by that country are feeling right now. So have you been able to gather a sense about what people are feeling who have some exposure either in Venezuela or outside to the processes of the Bolivarian Revolution?
I'm getting many emails from Venezuela, from Latin America, and there is incredible loss, of course, because we don't know what exactly is going to happen. I mean, we know that the process, the revolution is going to continue. We know also that the resistance, which is sponsored from the north, is going to intensify. So there is uncertainty it's not uncertainty in terms of whether there will be enough people who will be following President Chavez's legacy, but there is uncertainty about how much more fighting there will have to be to defend this revolution. Now, it's to me, President Chavez was a phenomenal person. I followed the Venezuelan revolution from the very beginning. When he came to power, I was living in Chile, in South America, in Santiago de Chile, and I remember I had to have many fights with my fellow leftists, fellow thinkers, fellow writers, because they were saying in southern part of South America, well, it's dictatorial, you don't take power in a coup, and I said, well, no, you have to act when there is no other way. And in Venezuela, there was no other way. He had no choice. So the way he came to power was very dramatic. To me, he's a poet. In a way, he was a poet. He went to study. He went to military so he could get free education. He was basically a thinker, a philosopher. And I think it's... it's something that we don't have in the West. It's just a remarkable, very brave figure. He was one of the few people in the world who could call names who could really describe the reality, but he was never afraid. He was really a brilliant and very brave human being. So he will be missed very much.
Chavez struck out, tried to change whatever ways were available to him. There was the coup, there was the organization of military officers. He eventually, to become president of Venezuela, had to mobilize people, the electorate, and show them that there was an alternative. And he had an interesting and very personable campaign when he first was elected. I came by for the World Social Forum in 2006. I saw him speak, and it was so amazing to see an elected leader stand up and discuss U.S. imperialism, calling it by name, talking about President Bush and what had happened to Iraq, and then about the changes that were happening even then in the country with the many social initiatives. So, I mean, as you said, here's someone who's not just talk. He was part of a movement to get out there and change things, almost as if he's from a different era.
Yes. And also, what is so important is in so-called third world or developing world, I wouldn't call Venezuela necessarily developing world. It was quite rich country, oil rich. It is quite rich, oil producing country. But you see, there is what he did, explaining the situation, calling things by their own names. It's unthinkable in most of the parts of the world. I'm right now in Africa. I'm speaking to you from Kampala, Uganda. And I was in Harare a few days ago, and 1 week I was covering elections in Kenya. These are Western outposts, basically. There is nobody who would dare, even in the government or opposition, everybody. I had a talk now with one very brave Ugandan writer, a lady, who spent some time in prison. And I said, well, is somebody going to finally address the collaboration of Ugandan regime with the United States? And she said, who would? The government is pro-American, and the opposition is getting funding from the United States as well. So nobody would dare to do this. Now, what to understand the importance of Chavez and Evo Morales and others is that you have people who just followed their ideals, very strong leaders who just said, we don't care about funding, we don't care about your money, we don't care about all your pampering that we could receive if we would join your camp. We don't care. We will just fight for the truth. We will fight for the independence. It's very rare. It's very rare in this world.
Yes, you actually made a parallel to the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom. You said a lot of people were upset about the global situation in the last 10 years, but we just spend all our time emailing each other or Facebooking one another or coming up with elaborate theories and explanations. But what you have to do is you have to get out there and mobilize people, and we see that that can have a major impact.
Yes, and also I would like to tell you something about my visit to Venezuela about 2 years ago. You know, I didn't travel only in the pro-Chavez areas. I went to the areas totally controlled by the opposition. I went to Maracaibo. I went to Ciudad Bolivar, to all these places. And I traveled by so-called porpuestos. And porpuesto is this huge American old car, you know, and it's shared by like five people. And it's really like it's traveling, like in traveling in 1960s, and they can afford it because gas costs nothing. Right? So I shared one of these porpuestos with the anti-Chavez gang, and there was like five people sitting there, and they told me, well, you know, you have all this Western, you come from the West originally, and you have democracy, we don't have democracy. I said, look, if I would be in the United States and I would be voting, it would be like sitting in this car on this very highway and just choosing whether I will be sitting in the left lane or right lane. I said, when you guys vote in Venezuela, it's like whether you go in this direction or whether you turn your car back and go the opposite way. Well, they didn't like it too much, but there was a good laugh about all this, but I think that this is exactly what it is.
Sometimes people take for granted when they have real political options.
Yes.
In the case of President Chavez, in my city, we partly had to rely on the Miami Herald for the reporting on that. And despite all the many people in Venezuela and that are involved with covering events, it's just not trickling here very much. And so that applies to any area that has tried to perhaps tug on its chains a little bit or move away from the orbit of empire, we get a very distorted view. It happened in the case of Venezuela, and it doesn't matter who or where it is. I mean, you were recently in Harare, in Zimbabwe, so you probably know just from the last few weeks a whole lot more than most of our professional journalists about daily events there. I mean, what's life like in Harare, and how are they coping with their political decisions?
Well, basically, the reason I went to Harare is because I read everywhere that Harare is the worst city in the world. The Economist had a survey in 2011, and it basically depicted Harare as the least livable city on Earth. And I read many reports, mainly from UK, but also from US, saying that all hospitals collapsed. There are no operation theaters anymore, basically nothing. So I thought this is very strange, because I was there, I was in Zimbabwe in the past, and it didn't look so bad. And I flew there for several days. And I, right now I'm writing reports for Counterpunch and others, and I'm saying, look, I'm not going to get into politics about Mugabe, or whether he's a big bad man, or whether he's a hero of African liberation. I said, I will just take you for a walk of the worst city in the world. And basically, what I discovered, it's shocking, because most of the things that I read were absolute propaganda. I went to the big, beautiful, super modern hospital with a great operation theater called the Trauma Center. Where it's a private hospital where actually people treat emergencies for free. So you come there, they stabilize you for free, and then they give you a choice whether you can pay or not. If you cannot pay, they move you to state hospital, which is also not bad, but they will treat you for free. Anyway, the two operation theaters there. Doctors told me there are several great hospitals all over Harare, and even public hospitals, which are crowded, are not bad at all. So I was walking through Harare. I saw great parks, public parks that you don't see in places like Jakarta, for example, or Cairo, where I recently worked also. And you see people reading everywhere. And then I checked, of course, the literacy rate is the highest in Africa now. Zimbabwe bypassed Tunisia as the most literate nation on the African continent. Then I realized there is almost no crime. It's very safe compared to Johannesburg, compared to Nairobi, and all this. And at the end of my journey, I asked the driver to take me to the slums. And he said, look, there is about 2 square kilometers or 1 square kilometer slums. And I went there. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I came from Nairobi, which is the biggest slums in the world, like Kibera and Matara, and the country is, like, of course, totally pro-Western, so nobody criticizes it. And I came in Harare to the slums that were consisting of some kind of a British public housing that was used for the poor people, you know, basically like dilapidated social housing, nothing worse than that. And that's like in the continent which has the most horrific slums in the world. So and not to speak about libraries and cultural institutions like art galleries and all this. Now, this is not to say that that Zimbabwean economy didn't collapse. It did collapse in 2008. But again, it collapsed because of the U.S. embargoes, because of the illegal embargoes, even on the export of diamonds from Zimbabwe, which I say illegal embargo because actually the diamonds are certified. These are not DRC Congo diamonds. These are totally legitimately produced diamonds. And because of the embargo, the country's economy, of course, collapsed. So, but despite the collapse in 2008, it recovered. And despite this, it's probably one of the most livable cities in Africa. But you would never guess it. You read the most horrific propaganda against it. And if you do, of course, if you sit somewhere in Toronto or if you sit in New York and you are evaluating or thinking where to go in Africa, you would definitely not take your family to the place which is described as the worst, place on earth.
Yeah, and it looks like there's not just an economic embargo, but an embargo on reporting itself. That shows why
exactly,
we need. That's why we have Andre, and you know that's why we're able to benefit from his articles. I personally look forward to reading your reporting on Harare, on your visit, on Zimbabwe, on other places in Africa. I know you've been looking at Rwanda, Congo. Those are things that are very hard to report on in Canada or the United States, but you have a more firsthand perspective. So there's a lot of good articles and reporting, writing coverage that have come from you, and I hope to see more of that and that our listeners can check that out.
Well, I would actually like to tell our listeners that within 1 week, I will finish an enormous film, more than 2 hours long, on which I was working for 3.5 years. And it's a film about Rwanda and Uganda plundering DRC Congo. And it's called Rwanda Gambit, and it's going to be probably the only film of its kind dealing with the issue how these two countries created the genocide of 8 to 10 million people, the biggest genocide basically after the Second World War. So this film will be out in about it will be finished. It's in Tokyo. It's being doing the last long distance post editing work, just basically putting my new re-recorded narration on it, but it should be out, and I hope that there will be at least some chance to show it anywhere in the West, because this is a big taboo. It's a big, big, big hidden, genocide that is going on until now.
A staggering topic, and certainly I hope perhaps we can show this film here. Staggering in its implications, in its scope, and in the limited coverage, very limited reporting we have on that issue, something that no doubt has garnered a great deal of your attention because of the controversy. It's been highlighted in Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and Project Censored, one of the top 10 censored news stories, the invasion of Congo. So you're right on that. Well, that's great. We'll get this out to our listeners, and we'll see if we can promote that film when it comes out. We're going to give links to the Counterpunch articles, give links to your personal website. It should be possible for people to access this, what we're not getting here. So, Andre, I wanted to thank you once again for volunteering your time at this very late hour. It's perhaps 1 a.m. there now, so we do appreciate that very much.
It's 1:10 a.m. in Kampala. But, Brendan, thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to talk to you, and it's really great opportunity to address Canadian listeners. Thank you.
Thanks, Andre.